Now today our lesson will be taken from chapter 23 of the Acts of the Apostles. I trust you'll get time to read this chapter at home and examine it for yourself, for here is another great episode in the life of the great Apostle Paul, which will be another link in the chain, ultimately leading him on to Rome. Now let me read the first 10 verses of the chapter by way of introducing our study. Acts chapter 23, and Paul, earnestly beholding the council, said, "Men and brethren, I have lived in all good conscience before God unto this day." And the high priest Ananias commanded them that stood by him to smite him on the mouth. Then said Paul unto him, "God shall smite thee, thou whited wall, for sittest thou to judge me after the law, and commandest me to be smitten contrary to the law?" They that stood by said, "Revilest thou God's high priest?" Then said Paul, "I wist not, brethren, that he was the high priest, for it is written, Thou shalt not speak evil of the ruler of thy people." But when Paul perceived that the one part were Sadducees, and the other Pharisees, he cried out in the council, "Men and brethren, I am a Pharisee, the son of a Pharisee. Of the hope and resurrection of the dead I am called in question." And when he had so said, there arose a dissension between the Pharisees and the Sadducees, and the multitude was divided. For the Sadducees say that there is no resurrection, neither angel nor spirit, but the Pharisees confess both. There arose a great cry, and the scribes that were of the Pharisees' part arose and strove, saying, "We find no evil in this man, but if a spirit or an angel has spoken to him, let us not fight against God." And when there arose a great dissension, the chief captain, fearing lest Paul should have been pulled in pieces of them, commanded the soldiers to go down, to take him by force from among them, and to bring him into the castle. Now we'll pause there for a moment or two in our reading. Now here in these verses then, there is the outline to us of the meeting of Paul with this great council in Jerusalem. We must look first of all then at the defense of Paul. He is put on the defensive. However, he gives a personal defense touching his own conscience. Then he gives a doctrinal defense touching his hope and belief. Note, no actual charge had been made against Paul at this time. Therefore, he was within his rights in taking the initiative and making his defense. You see, if the man sitting on the seat of authority had read out a charge against him, then, of course, he would have had to have answered the charge. But since there's no specific charge laid out here, simply they had brought him there because they would have known the certainty whereof he was accused of the Jews. They didn't know what it was. And so since there was no definite charge laid against him at this point, then he was quite in order to make his own defense. And in so doing, he speaks first of all about his own conscience. He says, "I have lived in all good conscience before God unto this day." Now, when he said that, the high priest commanded them that stood by him to smite him on the mouth, play words, tell him to be quiet. But Paul was within his rights for speaking. But this man said, as it were, "Be quiet, strike him on the mouth, tell him to be silent." You see? And Paul looked at him, and Paul said to him, "God shall smite thee, thou whited wall." What did he mean? Oh, here was a man acting the hypocrite, placing himself in a position, he said, of being a judge. "Sittest thou to judge me after the law, and commandest me to be smitten contrary to the law?" You see, Paul knew as much about the law, perhaps, as this man did. And here was a man pretending to be a representative of the law, and yet commanding these people to smite Paul contrary to the law. Now you see, this was a word of rebuke. Paul was uncondemned, therefore he was innocent. Here was an outrage of justice by the judge, because the judge commanded that Paul should be silenced by smiting him on the mouth. Paul's word of rebuke became, we understand, a prophetic utterance, because it's this man who was smitten of God. Now then, Paul noticed that the great council there was made up of two parties. Oh, it was a two-party system, all right. Two great groups were represented in the Sanhedrin. There were those who belonged to the Sadducean group, and those who belonged to the Pharisees. In plain words, you might say this: the Pharisees were the conservatives of their day, and the Sadducees were the liberals of their day. So Paul perceived this, and he very soon began to raise with them certain questions. Notice there's the contention and the division in the council. Paul raised the doctrinal issues of the messianic hope, and also the resurrection of the dead. Now this split the two parties who formed the council, that is, the Pharisees and the Sadducees, for the simple reason that the Sadducees did not believe in a resurrection. They simply believed you were born, you lived, you could eat, drink and be merry, tomorrow you die, and that's the end of you. Your body goes to the grave, it crumbles back to the dust, and you're no more, you're finished. The Pharisees had a different theology altogether. The Pharisees were more conservative. They believed there was a living God, and they believed that man was bound for an eternal destiny. They believed that after death there would be a resurrection. They also believed that there were beings who were called angels or spirits, while the Sadducees denied that. So far then as the hope was concerned, the Pharisees still held to the hope of their nation, that their Messiah would come, they would set up a kingdom, so on. Oh, the Sadducees didn't believe that. And so Paul very intelligently raised the issue with the council. When he saw that, he perceived that one part were Sadducees and other Pharisees. Then he said, now look, I am being called in question today regarding my hope and resurrection of the dead. That's what you're questioning me about. Now, the moment he raised that question, he could keep quiet then, and he could let the two different parties argue it out amongst themselves. But while they're arguing these things out, the fact of the matter is that there was going to be trouble. One party wanted to take him, and the other party wanted to take him. But the chief captain, who would be held responsible for the whole affair, made sure that he was not going to become involved in it. And so the chief captain, fearing lest something should happen to Paul, that he might be pulled in pieces or trampled to death or killed right there in the courtroom, he sent his soldiers down, you go and take him out, take that fellow out. And so they got Paul out, and they brought him inside to the place of safety, which is called here into the castle. Now, Paul is taken away then from that first hearing. Verse 11 is very interesting. Verse 11, I suggest to you, is a message of consolation. And the night following, the Lord stood by him and said, be of good cheer, Paul. For as thou hast testified of me in Jerusalem, so must thou bear witness also at Rome. Simple little verse, but how impressive. A word of exhortation. Be of good cheer. May I suggest to each one today that at that point in his life, Paul was in need of this encouragement. Now perhaps you have been at a stage in life, where you were depressed and you felt that everything was going against you, and you also required a word of encouragement. Well, here was a word of encouragement, a word of exhortation. Be of good cheer. Now, it's easy for people to say that to one another, but if you get it from the Lord, I tell you, my friend, it can encourage you. Be of good cheer. Paul was in need of this encouragement, and perhaps you are. And it may be this would be a good motto for you today, to write up in front of yourself, place it on your desk or on your table or in the kitchen. Be of good cheer. Not only a word of exhortation, a word of commendation. He says, for thou hast testified of me in Jerusalem. You see, the Lord took note of what this man had done and what he was doing. Thou hast testified of me in Jerusalem. And the Lord seems to commend him for that great testimony. I'm wondering, have we been able to testify for the Lord anywhere? Have we borne testimony for him, even in places where our testimony has been rejected? And yet we've continued to bear our testimony, not only by lip, but by life. Could we say with Paul that we have lived in all good conscience? Oh, Paul testified not only of his own manner of life, but he testified of what the Lord had done for him. He testified concerning his conversion. He testified concerning the truth of the hope of the resurrection. Thou hast testified of me in Jerusalem. The Lord takes note of us when we bear testimony for him. Then there is a word of prediction. For as thou hast testified of me in Jerusalem, so must thou bear witness also at Rome. Here Paul has it definitely placed before him now that the Lord would see that he got to Rome. Now at that point, Paul didn't know how he would get to Rome. Well, Paul had wanted to get to Rome for a long time. He said so when he wrote the letter that we call the Epistle to the Romans. He says, I am ready to preach the gospel to you also that are at Rome. And Paul was anxious to get to Rome, but he didn't know how he was going to get here. Now he was a prisoner. He's in Jerusalem. He didn't know what the outcome was going to be, except the Lord told him this, so must thou bear witness also at Rome. Now if Paul had notions here that he was going to Rome as a great preacher, he would learn later on that he would have to go to Rome as a prisoner. However, he would get to Rome. So must thou bear witness also at Rome. It's a word of prediction. But now, from verse 12 through to verse 22, there's a conspiracy. It's a kind of malignant conspiracy. Could you think of men being so cruel as to act like this? And when it was day, certain of the Jews banded together and bound themselves under a curse, saying that they would neither eat nor drink till they had killed Paul. After all, they didn't have anything really against him. He wasn't a criminal. Yet this band of people put themselves under oath, banded themselves together, bound themselves under a curse, that's under an oath, saying that they would neither eat nor drink till they had killed Paul. Now here's a strange thing. I wonder what happened to them that kept that oath. You know, taking an oath is a very serious thing, solemn thing. I can tell you this, if they kept that oath, they died of starvation. Because it was a long time after this, before Paul died, and more than that, they didn't put him to death. But they put themselves under oath. Look at the strength of the conspiracy. More than 40 evil men banded themselves together under oath to take Paul's life for their own. There were more than 40 which had made this conspiracy. And they came to the chief priests and the elders and said, we have bound ourselves under a great curse, that we will eat nothing until we have slain Paul. Now therefore, ye with the council signify to the chief captain that he bring him down unto you tomorrow, as though you would inquire something more perfectly concerning him, and we, or ever he come near, are ready to kill him. And when Paul's sister's son, that of course was Paul's nephew, heard of their lying in wait, he went and entered into the castle and told Paul. Then Paul called one of the centurions unto him and said, bring this young man unto the chief captain, for he hath a certain thing to tell him. So he took him and brought him to the chief captain and said, Paul the prisoner called me unto him, prayed me to bring this young man unto thee, who has something to say unto thee. Then the chief captain took him by the hand, went with him aside privily, and asked him, what is that thou hast to tell me? He said, the Jews have agreed to desire thee that thou wouldest bring down Paul tomorrow into the council, as though they would inquire somewhat of him more perfectly. But do not thou yield unto them, for they lie in wait for him of them more than 40 men, which have bound themselves with an oath that they will neither eat nor drink till they have killed him. And now are they ready, looking for a promise from thee. So the chief captain then let the young man depart, and charged him, see thou tell no man that thou hast showed these things to me. Look at this great conspiracy. First of all, 40 men banding themselves together, saying, we'll not eat or drink till we kill this man, a man who was uncondemned. Look at the subtlety of the conspiracy. These would be murderers, sought and obtained the cooperation of the rulers, who willingly compromised justice to obtain their objective. Friend, doesn't it affect you when you think of men getting into high places who are prepared to act like this? Willing to cooperate with men who are going to murder an innocent man. Now watch. Watch the sinfulness of this conspiracy. They were prepared to kill an innocent man because they disagreed with the doctrines he preached. Well now, a question or two arises here. While we see the sinfulness of sinful men, people raise an objection and say, how was it possible if these men took this oath? It was a private thing. They were a kind of secret group. How could they possibly take this secret oath and this young fellow get to know about it? May I remind some of you, friends, that if that's your objection to it, there's other scriptures that tell us that Paul was a Pharisee of the Pharisees. That is, he was a member of the inner fraternity of the Pharisees, a member of the inner group. Now here is a relative of his nephew. Now if Paul was brought up in that particular group, he likewise, his nephew, who got to know what these men were expecting to do, and so therefore, being acquainted with their secret oath, he comes and tells it. See, God moves in mysterious ways his wonders to perform. He plants his footsteps on the waves and rides upon the storm. You cannot fight with God and win. God was protecting his servant. He said, you've testified for me right here in Jerusalem. And Paul, you must also bear witness at Rome. And God has decreed that, and no matter what these men purpose doing, they'll realize this, that God can overrule their sinful plots. God can overrule their conspiracy. It may be strong so far as numbers are concerned. They may be acting with all subtlety and all sinfulness. But remember this, God has his hand right on his own servant and is able to protect the apostle. Now in verse 23 you're introduced to a great link in the chain. Verse 23 it says, and he called unto him two centurions, saying, make ready 200 soldiers to go to Caesarea, and horsemen 70, spearmen 200, at the third hour of the night, and provide them beasts, that they may set Paul on, and bring him safe unto Felix, the governor. And he wrote a letter after this manner. Now notice very carefully now how the plot was exposed. God has ways and means by which to upset the sinful plans of men. He can use these very men to carry out his purposes. He's going to send Paul now away to Caesarea, away from Jerusalem, and he's going to come under, as it were, another judge. Paul is removed to safe custody, and under military escort, Paul is taken to Caesarea. I don't know what it cost the Roman powers to do this, but see what they sent. 200 soldiers to go to Caesarea, and horsemen, 70 horsemen, 70 horsemen, spearmen 200, a whole army almost, to look after one man, and they're going to take him away to Caesarea. Now he writes a letter. Claudius Lysias unto the most excellent governor Felix, sending greetings. This man was taken of the Jews and should have been killed of them. Then came I with an army and rescued him, having understood that he was a Roman. Now you see how he praises himself for doing something he really never did. And when I would have known the cause whereof they accused him, I brought him forth into their council, whom I perceived to be accused of questions of their law, but to have nothing laid to his charge worthy of death or of bonds. When it was told me how that the Jews laid in wait for this man, I said straightway to thee, and gave commandment to this his accusers also, to say before thee what they had against him. Farewell. Then the soldiers, as it was commanded them, took Paul and brought him by night to Antipatris. On the morrow they left the horsemen to go with him, and returned to the castle, who, when they came to Caesarea and delivered the epistle to the governor, presented Paul also before him. And when the governor had read the letter, he asked of what province he was. And when he understood that he was of Cilicia, "Oh," he said, "I will hear thee," said he, "when thine accusers are also come." And he commanded him to be kept in Herod's judgment hall. Here then we have the record of the movement to Caesarea. First of all, now we learn that the plot was exposed. And then Paul is removed to safe custody, and he is removed under military escort. Now watch the plans and purposes of God and how they're brought to pass. These events are links in the great chain leading from Jerusalem to Rome. Paul has been assured that he will testify in Rome, but as I have indicated, he has not been told what the journey or voyage has in store for him. These things you learn as you proceed with the following chapters. But now, surely there's a lesson for us here. The lesson is this, that God looks after his own. The devil may oppose, but the devil can only go so far and no further. And God knows exactly how far to let these enemies go. But he's working all these things for the good of his own people. As the verse says in Romans chapter 8, all things work together for good to them that love the Lord, to them who are the called according to his purpose. And so all roads are leading to Rome, and in due time Paul will be put on ship and sent to Rome, when he is to appear at Caesar's judgment throne.